Here, apparently. Okay, we'll be on the record. Mr. Coleman, you may call your witness.
Thank you. The office would call Mr. Daniel Lawton and ask him to be sworn.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Please be seated.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are just starting. Your timing's perfect. We have Mr. Lawton on the stand.
Thank you. Mr. Lawton, would you state your name and business address for the record?
Sure. My name is Daniel J. Lawton, L-A-W-T-O-N, and my business address is 12600 Hill Country Boulevard, Suite 275, Austin, Texas, 78738.
Did you prepare direct testimony identified as OCS-1D Lawton, submitted to the commission on April 17th, 2014 in this docket?
I did.
And along with that, did that testimony also encompass exhibits OCS-1.1D through exhibit OCS-1.11D?
It does, and they were both all prepared by me or under my direct supervision.
Thank you. Did you also prepare surrebuttal testimony in this case identified as OCS-1SR Lawton, filed with the commission on May 22nd, 2014?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any changes or corrections to any of that testimony or any of those exhibits that you'd like to make at this time?
None that I'm aware of at this time.
So if I asked you the questions contained in both your direct testimony and your surrebuttal testimony today, your answers would be the same as contained therein?
Yes, sir.
At this time, I would move for admission of Mr. Lawton's direct testimony, the related exhibits, OCS-1.1D through OCS-1.11D, as well as Mr. Lawton's surrebuttal, May 22nd, 2014, into the record.
Objections?
None.
They're received.
Thank you. Mr. Lawton, do you have a brief summary of your testimony and position in this case to present?
I do.
Please proceed.
Thank you, and good afternoon, commissioners. I've changed my summary already from good morning, but we're moving along, and it's nice to be back again. Basically, the issues in this case, and I've outlined in my direct and surrebuttal testimony, is that on behalf of the office, I am recommending a 9.2% cost of equity for Rocky Mountain Power. The end result is a 7.26% overall return to be earned on invested capital. There is no dispute in my testimony between me and Dr. Hathaway or Mr. Williams with regard to capital structure. I agree with the capital structure Mr. Williams recommended in his rebuttal testimony, and I would urge the commission to adopt the updated capital structure as well as cost rates for debt and preferred. Our basic disagreement is the one big issue that you've heard about quite a bit this morning is the cost of equity. The models I employ are the same or similar models that Dr. Hathaway employs. The comparable groups of companies are quite similar. There's no major differences there. The end result is, do we rely upon the DCF, discounted cash flow, risk premium, or capital asset pricing models? I've outlined in my testimony what those results produce, what those models produce, and give you a range of results. The basic models, not only in my analysis, but in Dr. Hathaway's updated analysis, none of the models support a return on equity in excess of 10%. Moreover, they don't support a return on equity in excess of your currently authorized 9.8%. What I would ask that you look at, and I tried to outline throughout my direct testimony and throughout my surrebuttal testimony, are the following facts. Commissions like this regulatory body that have to make these kinds of decisions all the times, and like you've recently made and are making again with regard to return on equity, commissions around the country, regulatory authorities, are authorizing lower and lower equity returns. That's in the data of Dr. Hathaway's testimony as well as mine. That data is a fact. Interest rates have been declining since the end of last year, continue to decline. If we want to look at interest rate declines, Treasury rates and all interest rates have declined since the 80s. I mean, but recent declines are even more pronounced given what the level they're at as of December 2013. In terms of the Federal Reserve, I think there's some confusion. The documents are exhibits in the testimony. The Federal Reserve policy is to be accommodative. Yes, tapering has ceased, or is in terms of it's being scaled down. It's gone from $85 billion of asset purchases down to $45 million. But remember, this plan has been in place for a long period of time, and a lot of asset purchases have taken place. A lot of liquidity has been put into the market. So, and the end result is the interest rates you see declining, as well as the Federal Reserve statements on this matter. So I think interest rates are continuing to fall. They're at very low levels, and nothing in the evidence in this record supports the return on equity that the company is requesting. Rather, a lower return, I believe, should be authorized. And that's all I have. Thank you.
At this point in time, I would make Mr. Lawton available for cross-examination from the parties and from the commission.
Any questions?
No questions.
Mr. Monson.
I have just a few questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Monson. Good to see you again.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Okay, first of all, on this interest rate question that you brought up in your summary,
sure.
You would agree, however, that interest rates are lower, were lower, during Rocky Mountain Power's last case than they are currently on long-term.
Do you have a specific?
Yeah, we can. Do you have a chart in your?
I do. If you would look at my schedule, DJL3, OCS3, excuse me, in other cases, I call them DJL. OCS1-3D.
Okay. So if you look at the interest rates for 30-year treasuries in the fall of 2012, what do you get? Let's see, say September.
In September, you're seeing about 2.88%.
Okay. And then what do you get currently?
About today, it's 3.28%.
Okay.
A few basis points difference.
And that would essentially hold the same for any of these 20-year treasuries or corporate bonds? Not in the same ratio, but the same. They would have been lower in September of 2012 than they are today, right?
Right.
Okay.
Because the numbers in September or that period in 2012 is the lowest historical number ever for these securities, so any measure against it is obviously
right.
Going to be higher.
Okay, and that was the time that it's just before the commission decided the last case and the parties negotiated the settlement in that case, right?
That was the time period. I think the commission order came out September 2012 period, somewhere around there, or okay. The settlement was agreed to.
Right. Okay, and then on this the issue, I think you may have clarified this in your summary, but this issue about the Fed's policy.
Yes.
You agree that they are tapering the amount that they're buying of the longer term bonds.
Yes, they've tapered that in four different installments down to roughly $45 billion per month.
Right, and at least their announced plan is they're going to taper it further. They may change that, but right now the announced plan is they're going to taper it down to zero by the end of the year, right?
Their announced plan is there's no specific schedule of when the tapering will be completed. It could be adjusted by facts and circumstances.
Okay.
The expectation of the markets out there and other analysts are that it would be completed by the end of the year, but I think Chairman Yellen of the Federal Reserve said there is no specific hard and fast dead date.
Okay. And then, so when you say in your in your direct testimony, when you say on line 1033.
Excuse me? 10 what?
1033.
Give me a moment.
It's on page 40.
I'm there.
When you say that Dr. Hathaway is quite incorrect, the FOMC has not announced plans to change the course of accommodative monetary policies, you're referring there to the federal funds rate, I assume.
No, I'm referring to the tools in the toolbox of the Federal Reserve and the statements by the Federal Reserve that the Federal Reserve's policy on monetary policy will continue to be accommodative, and that's set forth in my exhibit OCS-2 in my testimony.
Okay, so you don't include, I guess, within that then the fact that they are tapering their purchases of longer-term bonds.
No, I think you're incorrect. You seem to be under the misperception that because we lower the amount of asset purchases, we're changing the course of accommodative policy. That's not the case at all. And as you can see from my Exhibit 2, is why I included it here, the language of the Federal Reserve is our policy will continue to be accommodative both for short-term and long-term rates. Remember, there's a housing problem in this country, and they're trying to get that market going.
So the fact that they've gone from $85 billion down to $45 billion, in your mind, doesn't reflect a change in the approach they're taking towards monetary policy?
No, not at all. It's a change in the tools and the mix of tools they're using.
Okay.
We got to keep in mind that the Fed, through the policy of quantitative easing, was making asset purchases of $85 billion a month for quite a few months. Those asset purchases have been made. That hasn't changed. That liquidity is still out there. That doesn't mean that the Federal Reserve planned to have $85 billion a month for 5 years or 10 years. It looked at the facts on the ground and determined that they could scale back to about $45 million as the new number.
Okay. All right, let me just ask you one other thing.
Sure.
You were the office's witness in the Questar gas rate case, right?
I was indeed.
And you recommended an ROE in that case of 9.25, right?
I did.
The commission ordered 9.85.
I believe that's correct.
So you were 60 basis points lower than what the commission found to be the appropriate authorized ROE.
That's correct.
Okay. And in this case, you're recommending a 9.2, but that's based, at least in part, on a 20 basis point adjustment for capital structure. Is that right?
For capital structure or, to be clear, financial risk differences.
Right. And so other than that, you would you have been recommending 9.4?
Absent another adjustment, yes.
Okay. That's all my questions.
Thank you. Redirect.
I have no redirect questions. Thank you.
Questions? Good afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Lawton.
Yes, sir.
In your opinion and in your experience, did you find anything anomalous about this year's modeling results?
Anomalous? No. The modeling results obviously have been, the yields have been affected. We all know that. But to say that, and by modeling, I'm referring to the discounted cash flow. And by the expected growth rates, the levels that they're at compared to other years, I don't see anything anomalous there. But I do agree with Dr. Hathaway to the extent that the yields have decreased because utility prices have increased in recent years. But overall, anomalous results that they can't be used, the answer would be no.
Couple of follow-up questions.
Yes, Commissioner. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to ignore you.
No, that's all right. So does that mean that you, the current utility stock prices are sustainable in your view?
I think that there are some sectors of the market right now that may be subject to the decreases or market correction. I don't know that, and I don't believe that the utility sector is going to be subject to such a correction until interest rates change substantially. And so in the short answer to your question, if you're referring only to utility stock prices,
right,
the answer is yes on the accommodative course of the federal government, which they plan to have for some time.
Thank you. Any questions based on ours?
I have no additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for having me. Lund.
Thank you very much. Captain Jernigan.
Yes, sir. The FEA would like to call Mr. Gorman to the stand, please.
Thank you. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you, Mr. Gorman. Please be seated. Captain?
Could you please state your full name and your employer, please?
My name is Michael Gorman. I'm employed by Brubaker & Associates, Chesterfield, Missouri. Okay.
And did you prepare and file direct testimony and sir rebuttal along with exhibits to both of those that have already been filed?
Yes.
And do you have any changes or corrections you would like to make to either of those?
I do. Some of these changes were made on an errata filed earlier, and some of the changes were found by Dr. Hadaway, and I agreed that some corrections were needed in my sir rebuttal testimony. On page 2, on line 25, the number 7.74% should be struck. The number 7.41% should be inserted.
And is that in the sir rebuttal?
The direct testimony.
In the direct.
I'm sorry. Thank you. That was part of the errata filed earlier. On page 12, footnote number 8 should be changed to footnote number 5. On page 37, on line 737, the number 6.3% should be changed to 6.2%. That same page and on that same line within the parenthetical, the number 6.9% should be changed to 6.6%. On my exhibit FEA MPG5, the column titles 2012 should be corrected to 2013. That would be under both dividend per share, earnings per share, and payout per share, or payout ratio, excuse me. And on my exhibit FEA MPG 17, page 1, on line 12 under the column reference, line 1 should be changed to line 4, and column 1 should be changed to column 2. That completes my corrections.
Would you mind restating those last ones? I just got to the right page.
I apologize. On my exhibit MPG 17, page
right.
1, on line 12, under the column reference, the line, it states page 3, comma, line 1. That should read line 4, and it states column 1, it should be column 2, COL, period 2 rather than COL period 1.
Thank you.
Those complete my corrections.
Okay. With those changes, if I ask you the same questions here today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
Okay. Move for admission of the of Mr. Gorman's.
Objections? They're received.
Would you like to give a brief summary of your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. In my testimony, I comment on the company's proposed overall rate of return. In my recommendations, I propose that the commission adopt a return on equity of 9.4%. In arriving at my recommended return on equity, I conducted three versions of the discounted cash flow analysis, a risk premium study, and a capital asset pricing study. In performing the discounted cash flow analysis, I performed three versions of that study. The three versions include a constant growth model reflecting analyst projected growth, a sustainable constant growth model reflecting the internal growth characteristics of the companies included in the proxy group, and a multi-stage growth DCF model which reflect a long-term transition from current short-term growth outlooks, reflecting the analyst 3 to 5 year growth projections, trending out to a long-term sustainable growth rate outlook, as reflected by what I believe to be the maximum sustainable long-term growth rate for a utility company. I also looked at the relative fundamental factors underlying the DCF components for each of the companies in my proxy group, and I find that the DCF model now produces fundamentally sound return on equity estimates. I did that in response to Dr. Hathaway, where I showed that the valuation metrics for utility stocks are reasonably consistent with long-term historical valuation metrics. Those include price-to-earnings ratios and price-to-cash-flow ratios. In my sustainable growth rate DCF analysis, I developed a growth rate reflecting the internal earnings growth potential of the utility stocks, and that included looking at whether or not the utility can afford their dividend and whether or not the utility can retain enough earnings in order to grow their earnings over time. Those analyses indicate to me that the fundamentals of the DCF model at this time are producing reliable results. In my risk premium analysis, I also reflected some uncertainty and risk in long-term interest rate markets. Those uncertainties are created by the current Federal Reserve policies and the ultimate impact on what long-term interest rates will be once quantitative easing is terminated. There is some uncertainty in the interest rate markets, and I try to capture that uncertainty by recognizing risk in the equity markets, which indicated to me an above-average equity risk premium was appropriate in supporting my recommended return on equity in this case. My capital asset pricing model, I used a forecasted treasury bond yield, which was significantly higher than current observable treasury bond yields, which I felt was appropriate given the uncertain outlook for interest rates in the current environment. Based on that analysis, I believe that my 9.4% return on equity is reasonable in consideration of the full analysis that I conducted to measure the current market cost of equity for Pacific Corp and Rocky Mountain Power. That completes my summary.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to submit Dr. Gorman to cross-examination, please.
Questions?
I have none from the office. Thank you.
Mr. Monson.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You did an analysis in your testimony that was intended to show that if the commission adopts your recommended ROE of 9.4%, that it won't negatively impact the financial integrity of the company. Is that right?
Yes.
And you did this by comparing the results for the company under certain ratios considered by rating agencies in determining the bond ratings, but using your recommended ROE of 9.4 versus the current authorized ROE of 9.8. Is that right?
No, I measured the financial metrics under the cost of service in this case using a 9.4% return on equity.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And In his rebuttal testimony, Mr. Williams noted that you had done that but didn't use the current S&P metrics. Is that right?
That is his testimony, and he is correct. S&P did modify their metrics in November of last year, and I used the metric formula, which had been in effect since around 2008, but it was revised in November of last year. So that is correct.
So you redid the analysis in your surrebuttal testimony, right?
I compared the benchmarks to the benchmarks in the new methodology. Yes.
Okay. Can you turn to page 2 of your exhibit 1SR? Have you got that?
Page 2?
Page 2, yeah.
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, and this is where you're getting your pre-tax rate of return that you're going to use in the analysis, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and I notice in your first, in column 1, the one that's numbered in 1, you end up with a weighting of over 100%, 100.17%. Is that right?
Yes.
And that would be an error, right? You can't have more than 100%, can you?
Yeah, there does appear to be a calculation error on that schedule, yes.
And so the number you use, 10.36% on that same row 4, would be an error somewhat. Is that correct?
I would have to review it, but it looks like there may be an error on that schedule,
yeah.
Yes.
And so then if we take that 10.36 back to page 1 of the same exhibit, that's used in your analysis for all these numbers, is that correct?
It is.
So those would also be an error, if that's an error.
A correction would be necessary, yes.
Okay. Another issue related to this analysis was a discussion about off-balance sheet debt. And you did accept an adjustment that's shown on page 4 of this exhibit, of $271 million, as I recall. Is that right?
Yes.
Just a little nitpick point, but on line 2 of that exhibit, you've got total Utah May 2013 rate base. Would that be total company instead of total Utah?
Which line are you looking at?
Line 2, page 4 of exhibit MPG 1SR.
Page 2?
Page 4.
I'm sorry, yes. On line 2, that should be total company.
Okay. Now, but anyway, the result of this is you've made adjustments to the off-balance sheet debt on line 6 of $271 million, effectively, right?
Yes.
And you remember, or I think you understand, that Mr. Williams made an adjustment of about 500 and some odd million.
Yes.
Okay. So do you understand what the difference is between his adjustment and yours? What's included in his and what's and then not included in yours?
Well, the difference is based on total Pacific Corp investment characteristics versus the financial obligations that are part of the retail cost of service in Utah. And there's also differences in the way Standard & Poor's treats some of the financial obligations of the company versus the regulatory treatment of those financial obligations. Specifically, one of the largest differences deals with pension and other post-retirement health benefits for the company. I believe Mr. Williams testified this morning about their health benefit obligation being underfunded. S&P recognizes that as a financial obligation. And that financial obligation is picked up in the cost of service in this case in a way that is different than the way S&P treats it. So if I recognized it in my financial metrics the same way S&P was treating it, it would be double counted in the cost of service methodology here. So the difference between what Mr. Williams is proposing to do with that particular off balance sheet debt obligation is different than the way I'm proposing to treat it here, because again, the way pension benefits and OPEB benefits for regulatory purpose treatment is different than the way S&P recognizes them in their financial obligation development. Another issue deals with accrued interest expense. And again, that's a difference in the way S&P treats it versus the way interest expense is recognized in cost of service. By cost of all the interest expense that is the obligation of Utah customers is reflected in a rate of return on rate base and possibly some QIP interest that is capitalized. In the rate of return on rate base and possibly in some QIP interest obligations. So again, there's a difference in the regulatory treatment and the S&P treatment. I tried to take S&P's general framework and modify it in a way that produces meaningful metrics, recognizing the regulatory treatment of some of those financial obligations. So I haven't replicated S&P's treatment, but I've been pretty true to the treatment, recognizing the distinctive differences and pension and some interest obligations of the company.
So then I take it that you're not saying then that you have compared the metrics that S&P uses with the current metrics to determine if there would be a deterioration in credit rating or in credit worthiness. You've done something different than that. Is that right?
No. The methodology, the regulatory process includes pension obligations in it. It includes OPEB obligations. So those are in the cost of service formula. They're being covered by the cash flows of the company. So I believe that I have captured them in my methodology in a way that is comparable to what S&P does. But to also make S&P's adjustment on top of the regulatory treatment, I believe would have double counted those financial obligations.
But you'd agree with me that when S&P does their analysis, they do include those obligations.
And I have also, I've just included them in a way that is consistent with the regulatory framework. To do what you're suggesting, I would need to move the cash flows out of cost of service, put them in the funds from operation, and then recognize them as additional cash flow to meet additional financial obligations. I believe that process would have been very difficult and likely would not have produced meaningfully different results.
Okay, and then you also mentioned that you have tried to take a Utah ratio and apply that to these numbers so that you're just looking at the Utah cost of service effect of these of the change in ROE. Is that right?
It is, because I'm trying to answer the question, is my proposed return on equity appropriate for setting prices for Utah customers?
Right.
Does it reflect fair compensation to the investments made in Utah? Does it support financial metrics that are consistent with investment-grade credit quality for providing service to Utah customers? That's what I'm attempting to measure with my metrics.
So when S&P makes its ratings and looks at these metrics, it doesn't look at just Utah, does it?
It does not. It looks at total company.
And when investors buy the bonds of the company, they don't just buy the Utah operation, bonds on the Utah operations, they buy them on the entire company, right?
Correct, yes.
So if you're trying to compare the difference between the cost of service, which I guess I misstated is 10% ROE, and you're 9.4%, and you're trying to do it to compare what S&P's ratings would be to show whether they cause financial impairment, you wouldn't take the Utah portion, would you? Because S&P doesn't take the Utah portion.
Well, S&P isn't concerned about just and reasonable rates to retail customers. That's the objective of what we're examining in this case. So in ensuring rates are just and reasonable, the rate of return has to be fair compensation and has to provide adequate financial metrics to support investment-grade bond ratings for the capital invested in Utah. That's the subject of this proceeding. S&P doesn't have the same subject in their review, but my subject is to look at whether or not the rate of return and cost of service elements in the retail service for Utah meets the Hope and Bluefield standards. So my objective, the questions I'm asking myself are different than the questions S&P is asking itself. Because S&P doesn't ask whether or not rates are just and reasonable. I do.
Okay, but S&P is one of the entities that determines the bond rating of the company. Isn't that right?
It's true, but it's also true that rates in Utah could be adequate to support strong investment-grade credit, but other elements of the company may not. So if you don't distinguish between Utah operations and other parts of the company, then Utah customers could be asked to pay excessive rates to compensate for other parts of the company that aren't covering their financial obligations. And I don't think that would be consistent with setting just and reasonable rates.
You performed a risk premium analysis in your testimony, is that correct?
It is.
In your analysis. And your risk premium analysis does differ from Dr. Hathaway's in certain respects, is that right?
One significant respect, yes. Yeah, but otherwise, it's fairly similar.
Okay. I mean, you used 1986 to 2013. He used 1980 through 2012, for example. Is that right?
Time period slightly different, yes.
Yeah. But and you also use different – you use a different bond than he uses, but you, of course, compare your risk premium to that bond versus what he compares to his bond. Is that right?
It's very similar, yes.
Okay. So the big difference, though, is this inverse relationship, right?
Between, yes.
And you don't agree there. Do you not agree there is an inverse relationship?
I believe that if you look at authorized returns on equity and compare them to contemporary bond yields, you'll see the equity risk premium for authorized return expanding when bond yields decrease. But the academic literature doesn't support that as the only factor that explains what an appropriate equity risk premium is. Academic literature is very clear. Changes in interest rate is one factor, but the true factor that changes in equity risk premiums, is changes in the risk of an equity investment compared to the current risk of a bond investment. When equity investments get more risky, the equity risk premium expands. Conversely, when bond investments get more risky in relationship to equity investment, the equity risk premium contracts. So interest rates are one factor that helps explain that, but it's not the only factor. And to assume, as Dr. Hathaway does, that it's the only factor, he significantly distorts what an appropriate risk premium is when you consider other risk factors and generally total risk factors in measuring an appropriate equity risk premium.
So one of the sources you cited for your statement that academic literature says that there's more factors involved is Harrison Marston, right?
Yes.
Can you turn to page 321 of your rebuttal testimony? Line 321, sorry.
I'm there.
Okay, and this is a quote from Harrison Marston, right?
Yes.
Okay. And if I read it correctly, it says, the market risk premium changes over time and appears inversely related to government interest rates, but is positively related to the bond yield spread. So they are saying that it's inversely related, aren't they?
They say it appears.
Okay. And then they say, let's see. Well, so even in the source you cite, they're acknowledging that they have that it appears there's an inverse relationship between risk premiums and interest rates.
Yeah, as I said, changes in interest rates are one factor, but they're not the only factor.
Okay.
And to assume, as Dr. Hathaway does, that they're the only factor allows for the misestimate of a fair risk premium in the current market.
Okay, so Dr. Hathaway did a regression analysis in which he plugged in as one of his factors interest rates and the other factor the risk premium, right?
No. He plugged in interest rates and commission authorized returns on equity.
Okay, sorry.
To measure risk premiums.
All right, okay. And he ran that regression analysis, and it showed that there was a correlation, an inverse correlation, right?
Yes.
And was it a valid regression analysis? In other words,
statistically, it was valid, yes.
Okay, it had a statistical result that's valid that shows that there is an inverse relationship, correct?
Yes.
So regardless of what the academic literature shows, that those facts show that there's an inverse relationship, correct?
I very strongly disagree with that. Statistical models are a method of measuring statistical correlations, but they don't explain the difference. Authorized returns on equity by regulatory commissions have decreased slower than current observable market interest rates. The market immediately changes interest rates, whereas the commission generally will reduce an authorized return on equity much more slowly than the market. And my perception of why they do that, having been in this business for over 25 years, is the commission is very conservative in changing authorized returns on equity because they have the responsibility to ensure that that return on equity meets the Hope and Bluefield standards. So the concerns I've heard expressed by many regulatory commissions is whether or not the decline in capital market cost is sustainable or whether or not it's going to go back to higher levels when rates are in effect. I've also heard commissions express concern about if the authorized return on equity is decreased too fast, is that going to cause problems with the company's ability to refinance its embedded debt to produce the sufficient earnings and cash coverage of embedded debt obligations? Keep in mind that a utility has contractual obligations with their embedded debt structure, so they can't immediately refinance that embedded debt when interest rates drop. They have to wait till the terms of the bond issue allows them to refinance it. So there can be a lag between a drop in the interest rate and the reduction in the embedded debt cost structure for the utility. So if the authorized return on equity was reduced too fast, you wouldn't get the earnings coverage of debt interest expense. You wouldn't have the cash coverage of debt interest expense, which we just talked about, consistent with the S&P benchmarks, that would ensure that the utility's financial integrity was preserved in the rate-making process. So it's my experience, having been in this business for quite a while, that regulatory commissions are generally rather conservative in reducing the authorized return on equity in the face of declining capital market costs. I believe it was referred to earlier by the department witness as a gradualistic approach to reducing the authorized return on equity down to current market capital cost, and I agree with that perspective. That's my experience.
So do you have a copy of Dr. Hadaway's rebuttal testimony?
Not with me, no.
I want to refer you to page 25. Let me, I've got an extra copy.
It's all right.
So, Mr. Gold, you can see on page 25 that Dr. Hadaway has a graph that compares authorized returns with, or excuse me, equity risk premiums with interest rates, right?
Yes.
And even without running a regression analysis, it does appear that there's some inverse correlation, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe it can be explained for the reasons I just went over. I think regulatory commissions adjust authorized return on equity much slower than the market will adjust, which is immediate, market-required debt cost.
So you did a risk premium result, a study, and your results varied from 9.36 to 10.24%, right?
Yeah, that sounds correct, yes.
Okay, if you want to
check that number?
Yeah, if you want to look at it, it's on your direct at line 658 to 659.
Sorry, you said 936 to 1024?
Right.
Yes.
Okay, and if you accepted that there was some inverse relationship, Dr. Hadaway redid your numbers and found that your results would have been 10.01 to 10.5. Is that right?
I didn't confirm that, but that's what he found.
And do you have any reason to dispute that that's what would happen if you apply his regression analysis and apply that factor?
Well, I dispute the accuracy of it, but I don't dispute the mathematics of it.
Okay. You were a witness, along with Dr. Hadaway, in a case before the Illinois Commerce Commission in 2011.
I was.
Do you recall that?
Yes.
It was Commonwealth Edison case?
Yes.
May I approach the witness? Thank you.
at home. No, I'm not giving it back. No. I thought that was for me.
Which party were you a witness for in this case?
The Illinois Industrial Energy Consumers.
Okay. Could you turn, first of all, does this appear to you to be a correct copy of at least a portion of that order?
It does.
Could you turn to page 153 of the order?
I'm there.
And could you read the paragraph, third from the bottom, that starts the commission finds?
Commission finds a testimony of IAC and AG/CUB relating to ROE as unpersuasive. The evidence shows that Mr. Gorman's estimated ROE is too low because his model inputs are negatively biased and that under current market conditions, his CAPM is unreasonable. In addition, the commission agrees with ComEd that Mr. Gorman incorrectly believes that the cost of equity for utilities have declined as much as interest rates.
So at least in the Illinois Commerce Commission's view, they felt like you had used biased inputs in the models. Is that right?
Yes.
And they also felt like that CAPM was unreasonable given those market conditions that they observed at that point. Is that correct?
His CAPM is unreasonable, yes.
And finally, they felt like you had incorrectly determined that the cost of equity had declined as much as interest rates. Is that what they said?
That's what they said.
And that's what we're talking about in this inverse relationship, isn't it?
No.
Isn't that the same issue? It's not
no.
the same issue?
It's okay. The issue is whether or not there's a one-for-one relationship with the reduction in return on equity and interest rates. I haven't asserted in this case that there is. In fact, I've proposed a method of developing an equity risk premium that is above average in this case, reflecting the risk of or the uncertainty in long-term interest rates in this case. I didn't do that in the Commonwealth Edison case. But in any event, that's a different issue than what we were discussing earlier.
Okay, but that gives you, and when you do that, it gives you a result from 9.36 to 10.24, right?
No, sir. I just said that's not the inverse relationship argument.
Oh, I thought you said you incorporated it in your risk premium.
We're talking about the Illinois Commission order still?
No, we're talking about this case, and you saying that you did something different in this case than you did in the Illinois case.
Yeah, in this case, I recognize the higher risk in the long-term interest rate market. And because of that risk, I felt that the equity risk premium widened. And I recommended a higher equity risk premium in this case to reflect that long-term interest rate uncertainty.
And the result of that in this case was that your risk premium results were 9.36 to 10.24%.
I'm sorry, correct? That's right, yes.
That's what I meant.
I apologize.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have. Oh, could we mark this as an exhibit since this isn't something that you would have had ready access to? I'm sorry. So I guess we should call RMP Cross 1.
It'll be marked RMP Cross Exhibit 1.
And I would offer it.
Any objection? It's received. Any redirect, Captain Jernigan?
Not at this time, no.
Questions from the commission? Commissioner LeVar.
Mr. Gorman, taking administrative notice of your testimony in the Rocky Mountain Power case 2 years ago in this commission.
Yes.
Your recommendation today is 15 base points higher than your recommendation 2 years ago. What would you say are the most significant, two or three most significant drivers that lead to that result?
Well, interest rates have increased since 2012. Utility stock prices have not. Again, we talked about the DCF fundamentals, or I talked about them in my summary. The DCF fundamentals are still pretty stable in this case. They're fairly stable in the last case. Are probably more so now. Utility payout ratios are 60 to 70% for the proxy group. That's in line with what the utility management are telling the marketplace that their target payout ratios are. That's an indication that the dividend is affordable and that they're retaining enough earnings to reinvest in the utility plant to grow rate base and grow earnings, which in turn allows for the growth in dividends. The bond yields of utility stocks right now are still above Treasury bond yields, and historically that's a measure of whether or not bond yields are reflecting current market cost of equity. Utility stocks yields are above Treasury bond yields, which is probably an indication that Treasury bond yields are artificially low because of Federal Reserve interaction in the marketplace, the monetative easing, quantitative easing practices. So I think in this case, as well as the last case, the DCF model results are pretty stable. So I'd say the increase in the return on equity is largely to modest increase in utility bond yields and more of a significant increase in Treasury bond yields since 2012.
Thank you. A couple of questions, Mr. Gorman. First, and this is a minor point, but I just want to make sure there isn't something going on here that I don't understand. If I look at DPU Cross Exhibit 3, I don't know if you have that in front of you, but this was the compilation of rate cases for the first quarter of 2014, and it adjusted out the Virginia Rider decisions.
Yes.
If you'd like this in front of you, just let me know. But my question is simply that this exhibit refers to an average of 9.62%. You seem to have examined, I think, the same data, and in your SIR rebuttal, I think your conclusion is 9.57%. And so I'm just wondering, are you referring to the same data set there, or do you know, and do you need this cross exhibit in front of you to?
Well, I don't. If you look at page 2 and 3 of my testimony, I actually quoted the Regulatory Research Associates, which is the company that compiles that data and publishes it, whether you get it directly from RRI or the Edison Electric Institute. Mm-hmm. And they made the calculation that I relied on.
Okay.
They stated that if you take Virginia decisions out of the first quarter of this year, the average industry average electric return on equity was 9.57. And again, that's in the quote starting on page 2 and continuing on page 3, and on line 38 of page 2, it's where they state what the ROE would be for the first quarter of this year for electric utilities, excluding Virginia decisions.
And I'll note that it looks like the cross exhibit that I referred to has SNL Financial LC as a source. So maybe that's simply is the explanation, is just two different sources of data.
Yeah, I can't. But SNL actually owns RRA, mm-hmm. So I can't explain the difference. It's possible that's the difference, but I would think that if SNL is publishing it, they would rely on their subsidiary that is in the business of tracking that information. But I can't explain the difference.
Okay. My next question relates to page 12 of your direct testimony. And I just would like you to elaborate on a sentence. It's a sentence that begins on line 235. And it reads, RMP's inflated common equity ratio indicates that the proxy group has less financial risk than RMP. And again, that's page 12.
Okay.
Line 235.
It's not a complete analysis of financial risk, but one general measure of financial risk is the amount of debt that is used to finance the company. The more debt, the more financial risk. The inverse of that is the more common equity, the less financial risk. As shown on my exhibit MPG2, with the 51.6% common equity ratio, Rocky Mountain Power's amount of debt is lower than that of the companies in my proxy group looking at the group average numbers.
So would that mean that the proxy group has more financial risk or less financial risk?
No, this is an equity ratio. So it's 1 minus the debt ratio. So it means it has less financial risk because it has less debt, less percentage of debt supporting the total capital using to invest in utility plant and equipment. So 1 minus the equity ratio is the debt ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And with a higher equity ratio, if you take 1 minus it, you have a lower debt ratio. So it's a little confusing because, again, a high equity ratio means lower financial risk, and conversely, a high debt ratio means greater financial risk. And the combination of debt ratio and equity ratio equals total capital.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, I will just may I just ask one question? On line 236, should it be indicates that RMP has less financial risk than the proxy group rather
yes.
than the way it's typed?
That's okay. correct, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think that's what was hanging me up a little bit, too. So the proxy group has a higher debt ratio than RMP.
Correct. And a lower common equity ratio.
Mm-hmm. And that would mean what with respect to financial risk for the proxy group?
Means the proxy group has greater financial risk.
Okay.
Than Rocky Mountain Power.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions based on mine?
No questions, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Berman, you're excused.
May I have just 1 minute?
Oh.
I might have one more
question. We'll be off the record.
I do have one question, if that's all right. And I don't have
Mr.
a copy
Monson.
Of this page, so I'll have to come and show it to you. But in Dr. Hathaway's testimony, he has the proxy group. And you, by the way, you used the same proxy group he did, right?
Yes.
And he has the an exhibit that shows the capital structure of the proxy group. Do you recall that?
I'd have to go back and review his testimony.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yes.
Where did that come from? Just so I can follow along.
It's that's a copy of exhibit SCH1 out of Dr. Hathaway's direct testimony.
Okay, thank you.
And what does that show the common equity ratio is of the proxy group on
for
average?
For calendar year 2012, it shows 50.1%.
Okay, and then what's Rocky Mountain Power's equity ratio?
Well, I had 51.6 at their direct case. It's closer to 51% now. But more recent information, as reflected on my exhibit MPG2, is that the proxy group's common equity ratio on average is about 49%, reflecting only long-term capital, as reported by Valuant. Correct, as reported by Valuant, which is the same source, I believe, as Dr. Hathaway's.
So this is just a timing. The difference in these numbers is timing, when you got your data.
Correct. Okay. Rocky or Pacific Corp's common equity ratio has come down, and so has the proxy groups.
Okay. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Gorman. You're excused.
Appreciate it.
Captain Jernigan, anything further?
Nothing further, thank you.
Is there any other business for the commission in this sub-phase of phase one? That is the cost of capital sub-phase. Anything further? Then we'll be adjourned. We'll reconvene in the revenue requirement phase of phase one on June 30th at 9 a.m. Thank you very much for your participation today. Thank you.